Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale, I'm a film critic and writer, and today I'm going to be talking to Robert Sellers, a man who has written a large number of books, histories of handmade films, biographies of Oliver Reed and Peter O'Toole, a collective biography of sort of drinking stories called Hollywood Hellraisers, just loads of fascinating books, and now he's the author of a new book called 1971, The Best Year Ever in Movies, told by an he's collected 100 movies to bolster his argument. It's a brilliant read, really, really interesting, and it can be read as a dip-in, dip-out sort of book, or it can be read all the way through, as I did. Anyway, we'll let Robert talk about it. It's a great conversation, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, subscribe, review, follow me on Twitter, at Dr. John T. I'm also on Blue Sky if you want to follow me there, if you have had enough of Elon Musk's nonsense. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the episode.
I tell you now, yeah, I much prefer asking questions to answering them, I have to say, yes.
Right, yeah, I imagine, because you've done... I remember reading a book of yours from some years ago called Hellraisers, which I thought that was my... I think that was the first book I read of yours, and that was such an entertaining book, and yet also, at the beginning, very entertaining, and then by the end of it, kind of tragic.
Well, I got one interesting letter was passed on to me from the publisher, and it was this guy who said he'd tried everything over the years to give up drinking, and he'd been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd done hypnotism, and he'd done all these things, and he read my book, and that was the thing that he said that made him realise, what am I doing? Because if it can fell people like Burton, these wonderful, amazing people, then what's it going to do to little old me? I better stop. So that was quite interesting that it had an impact in that way, because it was purely a piece of fluff, really. It's sort of a great... my concept for it was for it to be sort of like a greatest hits album. So instead of trawling through all of the Rolling Stones albums, you just get the greatest hits, you know? So it was almost like a greatest hits album, just all the best bits of their lives, really. So for it to have that kind of effect on somebody, a personal effect, was nice in a way, that you've maybe saved someone's life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I just found there were so many moments of real sort of tragedy.
You probably read my next book and went straight back on the bottle, but there we go.
What was your next book after that?
I don't know. It was the Hollywood version, the Hollywood, which they made a mistake because it was called Bad Boy Drive, which was quite a clever title.
Uh-huh.
But it should have been called, and the publisher said this later on, because the paperback was called Hollywood Hellraisers, and they said it should have been called Hollywood Hellraisers to start with, because it was, so this is the Hollywood version. So Bad Boy Drive, it sort of got lost a bit. And it, again, it was four people, you know, instead of the original Hellraisers, Burton, O'Toole, Ollie, and Harris, the Hollywood version was Brando, Nicholson, Beattie, and Hopper. And I think it's just as good a book, actually. It's much darker book, because I think with Burton and Ollie and people of that, and O'Toole and Harris, of course, there are dark elements, like Richard Harris throwing a wardrobe at his wife, things like that, which are quite... But there's a lot of sort of juvenilia in it, sort of, you know, schoolboy behaviour kind of thing. Whereas with the Hollywood crowd, it's much darker. It's more drug-related, you know? So it was a bit more... dark, yeah, but it's just as good a book, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I just find that the way you have this moment where, you know, people like Richard Harris, you have all these wonderful stories, and by the end of the book, Richard Harris can't remember. You know, he sort of gets to a house and he says, "Oh, I love this house. This is great." And they say, "Well, you've been here like 5 years ago. You were here for 2 weeks."
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certain, well, David Bowie famously says that he can't remember recording Station to Station album because he was on cocaine at the time.
Right.
And it was the same with these guys, that some of the films they couldn't remember making films, you know, which is extraordinary in a way, isn't it, when you think when the actual process of making a film or an album, going in every day to a studio or a film set, learning dialogue, acting scenes, discussing scenes, and then not for that all to go, is quite astonishing, really.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that Stephen King said the same thing about Cujo, that he was completely drunk when he wrote it, and he doesn't remember writing it. Yeah, when did you start writing, Robert? When was your, you know, how did you get into the business?
Well, my original ambition was to be an actor, because I'd grown up loving movies. I was lucky in that respect that my mum used to allow me to stay up and watch the Friday night horror films that used to be on. So I had this love of cinema, and it was always a special, growing up in the 70s, it was always a special event to go and see a movie. Not like nowadays where it's all multiplexes or they watch it all on streaming on their phones. Then you actually went to a cinema and it was a whole event. You had the adverts and then you got up and got your popcorn and the ice cream lady came down and the curtains were closed and the curtains opened, and it was almost like a performance in itself, you know, as opposed to the film as well. So it was a love of going to the cinema and a love of movies. So, I got into drama at school and wanted to be an actor, and that didn't go anywhere, unfortunately. But so I started writing about movies. Instead of being in them, I sort of started writing about them. I tried to get into the film industry, but it was like it is now, as a closed shop. So I just started writing, sending stuff off to film magazines when we still had them. Instead of now, we've just got one, isn't it? Isn't it Empire? It's still the last one stand. The Sight and Sound we have.
Exactly, yeah. But you're right. It's not exactly a huge market.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really look at Sight and Sound as a film magazine, really. I mean, I prefer the Empire type, you know, yeah, because that's my journalism. I'm not a sort of a Sight and Sound. I think there's two kind of film journalists, your Sight and Sound or your Empire, or in respect, sort of play, Photoplay, Film Review, you know. I much prefer that kind of thing to the Sight and Sound, sort of where everything is analysis, and I much prefer anecdotal things and stuff that happen, production stories and things like that. Than going in, talking about Hellraisers, it's all just drunken stories. There's no analysis of why they're drinking. I don't go into that whatsoever. I mean, some criticism because of that, but I think in itself it's a grave tale. You don't need to analyze why they're drinking. It's just it is what it is. But So I started sending off articles to film magazines and it was Film Review that got in touch and they thought I had something. And I started writing articles for Film Review and then doing film reviews for Enemy. And then I sort of got articles in newspapers and things. And then I started writing books. I'm afraid I've carried on writing books. Unfortunately, I mean, it doesn't pay the bloody mortgage, I'll tell you that. God,
no,
but it sort of keeps me off the streets. The only thing I can do, I mean, I literally can't do anything else. I literally can't do anything else. This is all I can do. I mean, I've had jobs in the past, office jobs and things. I'm bloody hopeless, but I can write a book. I can do research. I can interview people. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. I can put it all together. I think we're sort of people are made for certain things, aren't they? You know, people are very good at certain jobs. And I'm just, maybe it's a love of English as well. When I was at school, I loved English. I loved composition. I love writing stories. So I'm even though I'm writing non-fiction, I try and write it as a narrative, as a story. So again, this is the steering away from the sight and sound kind of aspect of where you're analysing things. I'd rather tell a story for the reader to sort of be involved in it and follow it as a narrative. You know, even though it's a piece of non-fiction.
Yeah. That's where I think your books absolutely shine. I love the Hellraisers book. I read the Oliver Reed biography that you did as well. And I was kind of like, there was a bit of me that was sort of going, do I want to go deeper into this guy's life because I've already read the parts in Hellraiser? And then
Yeah, Hellraiser's a different thing. Hellraiser's a different... Tell you a funny, because you just got them too confused. You said Hellraiser instead of Hellraiser. It's a funny story. We did talk about Empire. The Empire did this huge sort of convention, years ago, a couple of years after Hellraiser came out. I think it was at the O2. It was over a weekend, and there were film showings, there were panels and everything like that. And we went... No, this was when the graphic novel came out. You know, they did a graphic novel of Hellraisers, which was published about 8 years afterwards. And it was in conjunction with this. And they invited me and the guy, the illustrator, Jake, who did the amazing artwork in the book, to give a little lecture, a talk. And we'd done this a few things. We'd done it at Latitude and we'd done it at various places where I sort of discussed funny stories, and he would, in the back, he would have a sheet of paper and he would draw. So I'd do 10 minutes of Burton. He would draw a Burton on this huge bit of paper. And then I'd do Oliver Reed, do funny Oliver Reed stories, and he would draw Oliver Reed. So at the end of the talk, it was half an hour or so, he'd have drawn the four people and we gave them away to the people who wanted to came up to the stage. So it was quite popular. Anyway, we were asked to do this at the Empire thing, and two people turned up. And they thought it was Hellraiser. They thought it was something to do with Hellraiser. They're expecting talk about the horror film Hellraiser. And we said, no, it's Hellraisers, as in. And they thought, oh, all right, but I will stay anyway. So they watched it, and they obviously got two of these artworks each. So whether they've still got them,
which of those actors would you think of as your favourite from Harris, O'Toole, Burton, and who was the last one? Oliver Reed. Who do you think you like the most?
That's so difficult because they're all amazing, aren't they? But I think maybe Ollie Special is sort of one of the lads, wasn't he? He was a bit more sort of working class, a bit more blue collar. The others were a bit. I mean, they all came from humble beginnings, but they sort of had an air of grace about them, didn't they? Whereas Ollie was you know, they. Gin and tonics and champagne, wasn't it? Ollie was your real ale guy, wasn't he? So a bit more down to earth. So I've got affection for Ollie. But they were all amazing, amazing people. Great actors as well. You know, we forget, you know, amazing actors. Yeah. There was that interview, BBC Four re-showing a lot of Parkinson's interviews. And yesterday or 2 days ago, they had it's amazing interview with Burton, which is on YouTube, I think, which anyone listening should watch. He's there on his own, and there was no audience. I think I read that there was no audience. He didn't want to do it in front of an audience. So to get some people in the audience for some kind of reaction, I think they got all the cleaners from BBC Television Centre to sit in the audience. So there's about 10 or 15 cleaners. So you do hear some kind of reaction. And it's an amazing interview. It's a very illuminating interview. Yeah, but they're terrible. They were tall tellers. They did exaggerate. So it's very, some of these stories are maybe, so we say exaggerated to some degree.
I was gonna say, how did you sort of, you know, sift through? Because yeah, there's a, as soon as people start telling stories about drinking, there's everything is times by 10. You know?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Hellraisers, I'm afraid I didn't care. If it was a great story, I put it in. Was it Randolph Hearst, isn't it? You say, you know, something about printing the legend. You know, print the truth or print the legend. Always print the legend. You know, I think it's. Something along those lines. So, but I think when I came to doing Ollie's book, and also I did a big biography on Peter O'Toole, I think when you're doing a proper biography on the one person, I think then you have to be a bit more serious about it. Mm. So, yes, any story that had to be substantiated by somebody else, yeah. But what was quite nice was some of the more extraordinary stories from Hellraisers, it was nice to get that collaborator, shall we say. Yes. There's one great, one of my favorite Oliver Reed stories was when he was filming the Three Musketeers in Spain, and he was staying at this very, very posh restaurant. You'll have to edit that, won't you? He was staying in a very posh hotel.
Right.
And in the foyer where the restaurant was, where people had their breakfast and lunch and dinner, there was this huge pond of tropical fish. And one, in the dead of night one day, he came down at night and he took all the goldfish out of this tank, took them upstairs and put them in his bath. And then he got a load of carrots and with a knife all night fashioned these sort of carrot-shaped fish. And he popped them back into this huge tank, whether it was a tank or whether it was a pond, you know, ornamental pond. And anyway, what happened was in the morning when everyone's having their breakfast, he arrived and then dived in and came out of the water with one of these fish in his mouth. You know, it caused massive panic and consternation. And the police were called and he was dragged away screaming, "I'm a musketeer." And it was such an outrageous story, but it had to go in, whether it was true or not, it had to go in. And but I interviewed Michael York for the Oliver Reed book, who, of course, was in Three Musketeers. And I mentioned this story, and he said, "I was there. I saw it happen." So it was lovely to get somebody who was actually there can say yes.
I sometimes wonder if some of these stories are amazing to read and amazing to enjoy in retrospect. But if I was actually, you know, making a film with Oliver Reed, I'd be terrified. You know, I don't know if I'd be able to stand him.
People were terrified of him. Yeah, people would have the amazing thing with Oliver Reed was that people would talk to me and say that they could just about handle one evening with him. And that was it. But the thing was, with Ollie, that was every night for him. Whereas that was enough. You know, I spent one night with him, never again. But that was his whole life, that he lived like that, which is extraordinary, really. When he was on set, I think when he was at home, not really. I mean, when he was at home, he was just as bad, actually. He had this gang of workers. He had this lovely house that was being renovated. And it took about 10 years to renovate it because he kept saying, "Are the bricks, you know, are the walls finished yet? Or have you finished that?" And they said, "No," because he'd keep taking us to the pub. He'd come round and say, "We're off to the pub, sod the wall, we're off to the pub." So it took years and years to renovate this place because they were spent most of their time in the pub.
Did you ever get an opportunity to meet Oliver?
No. It was a great privilege and honour to speak to all his family, to his son and daughter and his brothers. So that was a real, real honour. And his wife and two wives, actually. I never met any of them. No, I saw O'Toole many times on stage in the Geoffrey Bernard and also in a George Bernard Shaw, Man of Superman. He's, out of the four, he's probably my favourite actor of the four, O'Toole. There was always something artificial about him and over the top. He wasn't Brando at all, was he? He wasn't a naturalistic actor. Very much a theatrical, even on film, a very theatrical actor. And I love that kind of acting. I love that sort of theatrical style of acting, which all four of them had. Less so Oliver, actually. Burton was always a bit over the top, wasn't he, as was Harris. Ollie was actually quite a minimalist actor, isn't he? If you look at films like The Brood, superb in that, particularly the opening scene. There's an opening scene, isn't there, where he's this therapist, isn't he? And he's doing this therapy thing with this patient. Fantastic acting. He was very underrated as an actor. Yeah. So yeah, I thought. But yes, I never met them socially, no, unfortunately.
Or fortunately, depending on.
But it would have been lovely to have met, because they're heroes of mine growing up.
Right, so
it would
have been lovely
to. I almost met Harris when he was doing reviving Camelot in the early 80s in London. Unbeknown to me, as a birthday treat, I must have been about 14. My parents bought me a ticket to see, and I think it was the last night or something in the West End. I went to see it, but unfortunately the night before, I think he'd been drinking, he fell out of a taxi. So was out of action. So it's stand in. So that was disappointing. And years later, I found out that had Harris been there, I was going to go to the dressing room and meet him. They'd arranged for me to go in and meet him and talk. And yeah, so that never happened. So that was a real shame. Yeah. But that would have been incredibly intimidating. I'm not sure. Wow, that would have been very intimidating.
That's amazing, sort of close call. You got almost got there.
Yeah. I went to a few stage doors and never met them. Yeah. I do get nervous around famous people, although there's not many famous people left in the world anymore. But sort of they're all dead, aren't they? The Christopher Lees, the Peter Cushings, the Connerys, Kane is left. But yeah, I remember meeting, obviously doing a lot of magazine work and books. I get to interview an awful lot of people, and meeting and interviewing people like Roger Moore is a real, you know, it's quite intimidating. I get quite nervous. And I remember going to see Roger Moore, and I was waiting for about 10 minutes in the foyer for him to come down from his, yes, Mr. Moore will be down in a moment, which is already makes you shake. And then, yeah, there he came out of the lift. But, you know, you get over that, and they're very good at making you feel sort of, and you want to say, you know, you want to do a, I'm not worthy kind of thing, you know. I'm sure they hate that. They must hate that when people sort of grovel around them, you know, saying, you don't know what you've meant to me, blah, blah, blah. They must hate that. I don't know, because they get it all the time, don't they? But sometimes when I'm interviewing people and I do say, look, you know, I was a big fan of yours, and you know, when I was growing up, and you meant a lot to me. I have done that. I interviewed Graham Garden recently, The Goodies. And I grew up loving Monty Python and The Goodies when I was a kid. The Goodies, especially, I loved The Goodies. They were my heroes. I bought all the annuals and the albums. But people who don't know The Goodies, they were really huge in the 70s. They were sort of on a par with Python in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember Goodies came before, but not before in terms of time, but in terms of me watching them. I watched The Goodies.
Absolutely. They were our Python.
Exactly. And Python I watched as a repeat.
We were too late for Python, weren't
exactly,
we?
Exactly, yeah.
The repeats. Yeah. But they were our Python, you know.
Definitely.
And I had to say to Graham at the end of my interview that, you know, you meant so much to me because I was such a huge fan. So it's just nice in a way to say that, yeah. And I think they do appreciate it, yeah, yeah.
I think there's a way of saying it. You know, there's a way of not, I mean, it's about, I always try to maintain a sort of level of professionalism when I'm meeting people. And it's like, okay, I've got a job to do. I've got to get this.
That's why you're there, isn't it?
Exactly,
You're there to interview for whatever, not to go, oh my God, I remember going to see, interviewing Donald Sutherland. I was doing an article about Look Now for Uncut Magazine, which is no more. That I was really, really nervous there, and I just something ridiculous. He blew his nose, and he was in the West End at the time, and he was in his dressing room for after the matinee or something. And I'd gone to see him to interview him, and he blew his nose, and he tried to throw the tissue paper into the bin that was at the other side of the dressing room, and he missed, and he went up. To get it. I said no, I'll do. I almost said it would be my pleasure to do it, but I didn't. It would be my privilege to put the
royal snot rag,
soiled. But I did. I got up and said, "No, I'll do it." Yeah, it's the least I could do, Mr. Sutherland, kind of thing. Yeah. Because the thing is, I've grown up watching these people's films. I've grown up watching Don't Look Now and Kelly's Heroes and Dirty Dozen and Eagle Has Landed, and you know they're part of my life, part of growing up. And when you actually meet them and talk to them, I think it's an extraordinary thing. I did this book on ITC, the TV shows of ITC, which is Lou Grade, who did all of them. The Persuaders and The Saints and Prisoners and all the Gerry Anderson shows. So I grew up loving Thunderbirds and all of those shows. And I interviewed Gerry Anderson for the book. And at the time, he had an office at Pinewood. And because he did about 10 shows for ITC, there was no way we could do it in one interview. And I ended up going to Pinewood about six times to do these long interviews with Gerry. And that was a real pleasure to be able to really grill someone like that in all the minutiae of the show and talk to him about how he came up with all these ideas and stuff in real detail. And by the end, you know, he was very open and was telling me stuff that he hadn't told anyone before. He said, look, I've never told anyone this before. So to develop a relationship over a period of time with someone who had been so important in your childhood was amazing, really. It's a privilege sometimes for us, isn't it, to talk to people that we admire.
Absolutely. And sometimes, and especially when it feels like that develops into a conversation, it's always interesting. And when
almost you... a friendship, mm. Well, particularly over a period of time. If you keep going back to see this person, Vic Armstrong, I ghost wrote Vic Armstrong's memoirs. And they've
There's another Vic book Armstrong. I've read. There's another book I've read.
What an amazing man he was.
What a great book that is.
That took about 5 years to write. Not because it took 5 years to write, but because, you know, for 6 months, he'd be off shooting a movie. Mm. So there wasn't much time to actually sitting down and get stuff going. So it took a long time. But that has become a friendship. I'm still in touch with him today, you know, and what a great guy he is. And that was a privilege to write that, to help somebody like that, you know, put his life story and his life work onto a document, you know, to create a document about his life. You know, it's real responsibility that you feel to be asked to do that. You know, you've got to, it's very difficult to ghostwrite because you can't write it as you would a normal book, because you have to write it in the way that they're talking, in a way, to get the voice of that person, which is quite difficult when you're ghostwriting. But with someone like Vic, who's a great storyteller, you should get him on your podcast. Oh, no, he's Writers, isn't it? Yeah, sorry. Yes, it's specifically Writers, isn't it? But he's a great storyteller. Yeah, that was a pleasure and a privilege to work with Vic on that and to be welcomed into his home and family for, you know, over the course of 5 years. Yeah, he picked me up at the station and take me back because I don't drive, you see, so I felt like a complete hanger on, you know. He'd pick me up and drive me back to the station. Yeah,
that book begins with him sort of in the rafters of the, you know, Blofeld's lair and then goes all the way on to the Indiana Jones films. And
absolutely, you know, that was his second movie, only twice, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
I think they only got it because he was, his surname was A. Armstrong. Because they're probably flicking through the stunt, you know, register or whoever's black book they've got with contacts. And they look at the first name Armstrong, give him a call. Oh, no, that's how he got on Her Majesty's Secret Service. That's not how he got secret, only twice. That's how he got on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Yeah. They must have just gone to A and he happened to be in. Because if he wasn't in, they would have gone to B and got somebody else. And that was a huge, that was quite a breakthrough for him to do Secret Service. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great book. Yeah. Yeah. And again, just full of anecdotes. That's basically what it is. You know, so we don't go into, you know, what this means or what that means.
Isn't that the thing, that if you put those stories together, you get what it means comes up anyway?
I totally agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you need, sometimes it's difficult because if you're writing a book on whatever and you're thinking, sometimes you have to analyze something because it's there. You have to talk about it in an analytical way, why this happened and what it meant. Yeah. Sometimes you have to do that. But there's other times where you don't. You say, look, it speaks for itself. You know, by the time you've ended the book, you sort of know what's going on or what it means. So, yeah. So I agree with that. Yeah, yes. And it's also, I'm quite lazy and I'm not very good at it. I'm not very good at sort of, you know, really going into psychological deep stuff. Not that kind of writer, because I'm not very good. I can't do it. So I fall back on silly anecdotes.
I don't know. I mean, I sort of think people are what they do. So it's, you know, you tell me what these people do and I'll kind of know who they are. You know, it's...
But that's, again, going back to the journalism thing, you know, I'm not a sight and sound coherent to cinema. Because I remember when I worked at the Vintage Magazine Shop. Do you remember a shop called the Vintage Magazine Shop?
No, where's that?
It was a film shop. It was a movie shop in London. I worked there for about 2 years. Again, because I love film. So if I was going to work anywhere, I was going to work in a movie. It was a memorabilia shop. They sold, you know, posters and stills and things like that. And I remember there was the guy, manager there, and he was a real sight and sound guy. And I used to get film review. We couldn't be more different, you know. And he said, no, I like, when you read a review or an article, it's all about the meaning of a film, like an interview with the director, whoever, whatever director it is, it's about what he, and sometimes it isn't the meaning, is it? It's like the person's making it up, you know. It's not, I think it's all fake. I think that it's all fake. Because I remember, I'm a big Bond fan, as you probably know, and there's a very insightful review of Dr. No. When Dr. No first came out, it was obviously quite controversial because it was, you know, it was fairly a violent film to some extent, you know. And there was, interestingly, it was Sight and Sound. Pretty sure it was Sight and Sound. The reviewer of Sight and Sound gave it a horrendous review, saying it was disgusting and violent. And he said it's disgusting because, but what do you expect from the director of Hammer horror films, Terence Fisher? He thought it was directed by Terence Fisher instead of Terence Young. So he based his entire review on the fact that he thought it was Terence Fisher directing it. There's something about that kind of journalist, doesn't it? That you know, instead of taking something at face value, you put it through your own prism, you know, instead of actually seeing it for what it is. And there's another great example, the TV show The Prisoner. You've got those amazing, we all know the scenario of The Prisoner, don't we? It's Patrick McGoohan, who's sort of a prisoner in this village, and he can't escape.
You are number six.
Yeah, that's it, yes. Oh, I'm not a number. I'm a free man. And if anyone tries to escape, this giant white balloon comes and sort of smothers them. Brilliantly parodied in a Simpsons episode. And lots of people over the years would sort of, what's the reason for this? They would analyze what this white sphere means. And the only reason it's in there was because they had, originally it was going to be a submersible vehicle that came out of the sea and sort of tracked people. And it never worked. The special effects people could never get it to work. And while they were shooting that scene, I think there was a weather station nearby and they saw these white balloons in the sky. And they just had this idea, get 10 of those. And I think the production assistant ran off to where this weather station was and brought back these balloons. So they just got it because you just saw them floating in the sky. But you've got literally people wrote bloody books and theses on what these white balloons meant, you know. And I don't know if it's apocryphal, but there's a film which is in colour and there's a sequence in black and white. This may be apocryphal, but it's fuel to my argument. And there's one scene that's in black and white. And again, all the reviewers came out, what this white suddenly went into black and white and all these reasons for it. And they just ran out of money. They couldn't afford black and white stock. I don't know if that's apocryphal, but I did. It comes to mind, but anyway, yeah, that's my rant. That's my rant over.
There was a story about Sergio Leone making Fistful of Dollars, and he bumped into like the most important film critic in Rome, and the guy said to him, "Leone, this is a masterpiece. What a brave movie! You've shot a western entirely in red, the color of blood." And he went, "What do you mean entirely in red?" And he phoned up the developers, and they. Basically, it was a three-color process, and instead of mixing them and sending out the mix, they sent out just one strip, which was the red the red color. And he was sort of like, do I tell this critic that that was a mistake? Or do I let him write his review under that misapprehension?
Fantastic. Again, it's looking at something through their own prism, isn't it? It's red, therefore, what does it mean? And it doesn't mean anything. It's the wrong bloody... It's come back from the printers wrong, you know. And I think directors themselves... You know, get a bit. There's lots of interviews, isn't there, where people have said, "Oh, does it? This film means that?" And the director just says, "Well, no. It's just entertainment. It's people can read into whatever they want." There's a great Peter Sellers film called After the Fox. Do you know?
Yeah. It's shot in Italy.
They're criminals, aren't they? And they have to get this gold in from a ship. So they go to this Italian village and they pretend to be shooting a movie. So, and they pretend to shoot the goal coming in, so people think it's part of the movie, but it's actually the heist happening before their eyes, kind of thing. And they're all caught at the end, and they're all in court, and they show the film on the screen, and it's just awful, because obviously the person doing the cameraman can't. It's all going all over the place, and the editing's all over the place, and everyone looking at it in incredibly embarrassment, you know. And then the lights come up, and there's silence, except for one film critic who stands up and applauds it as a masterpiece, like Jean-Luc Godard, you know.
Yes.
And I think that's a little dig, isn't it, at the critics. So I approach books in that way, you know. Like, so let's just it's. You know, entertainment, isn't it? It's just full of funny stories, which is, you know, most of my books are. If you look at them all, they're also very, very anecdotal in that way.
Well, and your new book, although it's sort of set up as 1971 as a series of reviews, even in that, there is a lot of stories in, you know, how the films come to be made and the relationships, and it's full of absolute gems.
Again, this is why I'm going on about if people think, why is he talking about this? But yeah, I mean, because I could have approached this book in a very different way. I could have approached it looking at, particularly because there's some very important films, like Panic in Needle Park and Punishment Park and films on Vanishing Point, where, you know, people have written a lot of stuff about very, very important subjects like drugs and, you know, politics and things like that. But I'm just always looking for the funny story where somebody fell over or the camera, you know, the film came out of the camera. You know? But it's nice that, I mean, I've had it when everyone's dead, because I've got, you know, you need the people who are there, and usually they've got funny things to say or interesting things to say because they were there. Whether I think I said somewhere that it doesn't matter. All the great people are dead, and all the directors are dead, and all the great actors are dead from those films. So you're usually talking to the person who's the third assistant director or something, but they've gone on later on to have quite successful careers. But it doesn't matter. You can make the coffee on the set of French Connection, but you were on the set of the French Connection. So, you know, you've probably got something valid and interesting to say. I interviewed the guy who was the location. He wasn't even the location manager, but he just went around looking for locations on Clutes and French Connection. Pretty fantastic. And he told me a very interesting story about Jane Fonda. You know, they found this place, like a warehouse, where they could build her apartment, the set of her apartment, the character that she was playing, who was this prostitute. And they built this apartment set in this sort of warehouse. And she said, I want to stay in that set for 2 days and two nights. I want to live in that set for 2 days and two nights. So when we come to film on it, I know where everything is. And it's not a mystery where the phone is or where the fridge is. So it's completely natural when I'm moving around in that space. And that's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, you never thought of that, you know, an actor's process working like that. Because if an actor comes onto a set and it's supposed to be your flat and your character's flat and you don't know where the fridge is, you're going to look sort of unnatural in there, aren't you? So it was brilliant. When you think about it, for Fonda to say, no, I'm going to stay there for two whole days. So I familiarize myself with the environment. So it comes across on screen perfectly natural that this is my home. Yeah. So, yeah. So I prefer things like that. That's very interesting, you know, from a sort of an acting perspective.
I love one of the, you know, speaking about talking to different people who, you know, you talk to an actor who plays the least famous and the youngest Droog in Clockwork Orange. And that, I thought that was a really interesting perspective to have.
Yeah. Well, because I couldn't get Malcolm McDowell.
But then again, everybody knows what Malcolm McDowell thinks. True. He's spent the last 40 years talking about it.
This is true. But if I got McDowell, but then this other guy's memories and story were equally valid and would have been in the book as well, because it's interesting because he was the only guy in the Droog's gang who was actually a kid, because they're supposed to be kids, aren't they? They're supposed to be young teenage or late teenagers, aren't they? But they're all in their mid-20s, you know. He was the only child. He was sort of 16 at the time. And yeah, he gives illuminating thoughts on it, and also about Kubrick as well, talking about Kubrick. Can you imagine working with Kubrick for a year on that film? You really get to know him. And not many people got to know Kubrick, I can't imagine. So very interesting.
Yeah, I love the way he suggests that he should Lord of the Rings as his next film.
Yeah, and I think Kubrick said, no, I'm not making Spartacus again. I think meaning he didn't want to make a big, epic kind of movie again. Yeah, which is very interesting.
Wow, that is, and I mean, the range of films here, I mean, it's always going to be contentious when you say 1971, the greatest year of cinema, but it's a pretty good collection of movies. I mean, even the bad movies are amazing movies. You know, I mean, like,
yeah, that's what I thought. That's why I did. That's why I had to approach the book, and I came up with this concept of doing 100 films. And I think that gives weight to the argument of this being the greatest year, because if you look at other years, I think there's been a book, hasn't there, on 1999. There was a book a couple of years ago in 1962, which I've only just found out. I mean, if you sort of look at 1939, or is an obvious candidate as well, there's some amazing films, but I don't think.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If by the time you get to like number 79, I think you can be scraping the barrel. But I think 1971, even though some films are weightier than others, shall we say, they're still fascinating and interesting. So and I had no problem at all finding 100 films. That's why there's a chapter, there's a sort of an overspill, because there's some really interesting films that didn't quite make it. Some really bad films. There's one film that in the end, because there was nothing even remotely interesting about it to write, but it was Werewolves on Wheels. It was a biker werewolf movie. It sounds amazing, doesn't it? Because that final chapter was actually going to be called Werewolves on Wheels, to sort of say that it's like the worst of the best, right, of the rest, kind of the worst, the weird and the wonderful. But researching it, and it looked bloody awful, and there was nothing particularly interesting to say about it. So in the end, it never made it.
That's it.
But it was that. Let's put the weird and the wonderful in the final chapter. So there's some interesting stuff, and there's people I interviewed as well from that who say have got some great stories. Zolkind, who produced the Lighthouse, the Light at the Edge of the World. It's Jules Verne film. It's an incredibly violent movie. So he said some very interesting things about star power, about how they got Kirk Douglas. You know, basically, before I even talk to you, you put $250,000 in my Swiss bank account, and then we can talk. And then he said, okay, maybe I'll think about it. And now that I've committed to it, now you pay me $1 million. But because you paid me $1 million, you can now go around the world and say, we have Kirk Douglas to star in this movie. And that's the way that they raised the money. A star. That's how you get a star. That's how you used to get stars in those days. Yeah,
absolutely. And then you have there's such a wide range of films here. Yeah. Willy Wonka is one of those perennial favorites. But to read the book and realize that it's kind of, you know, it's so much happenstance involved in the making of that film, and that it was kind of like a big advert for a chocolate bar.
It was Mel Stewart, who I interviewed. Well, I started doing this about 10 years. I had this idea about 10 years ago, because some of these people are no longer with us. I interviewed Robert Fuchs, who directed Abominable Dr. Fibes. He died a few years ago, so I managed to interview him, Ken Russell, Michael Winner, and people like that. So I had this idea about 10 years ago, and it would have made sense to have brought it out 2 years ago for the 50th, you know, in like 2021. But nobody wanted to publish it. It took me quite a while to find a publisher. So I had these boxes of tapes. So when I interested this publisher, History Press, into doing it, I went back up into my loft to dig out the tapes that I'd done years ago when I had the original idea. And I was going through them. I saw one tape saying Mel Stewart. I thought, who the hell is Mel Stewart? And I put the tape on to listen to it. Oh, it's the guy who directed Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Fair enough. And yeah, he's some great stories. I mean, he was with this with a partner called David Wolper, and they had this documentary filmmaking company. They did documentaries. They didn't make movies. They made adverts and documentaries. But one morning, Mel Stewart's daughter came in and said, she just finished reading this wonderful book, Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. You must make a film of it, Daddy. He said, well, Daddy doesn't make films, makes documentaries and adverts, so I don't, but I'll read it, I'll have a look, because he was very enthusiastic about it, so maybe there's something here. So he read it, loved it. Next morning, he went into the office and gave it to his partner, Wolper, and said, read this, whether he did or not. But about a week later, they had a meeting at Quaker Oats, because they did documentaries for them and corporate films and things like that. And they had this big meeting at Quaker Oats, who were going to be bringing out this chocolate bar. And so they said, have you got anything about chocolate, or history of chocolate, or anything like that you can do? And then the little bell went off in their head and said, well, actually, there's this book called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And they loved the idea. And so the whole film was financed by Quaker Oats. To tie, it was basically a giant advert for their chocolate bar, which they persuaded them, instead of Quaker chocolate bar, it became a Wonka bar. And it was a complete failure. The chocolate bar was a failure. The film was a failure as well, relatively. It wasn't a huge success. It's only, you know, it's one of those films that sort of gathered pace later, you know, when it turned up on television and people started watching it. And then fathers showed their, you know, generations and generations. Mm. And now it's this absolute, you know, classic movie, isn't it? Another one is Bed Knobs and Broomsticks, again from 71. Again, wasn't a huge success, but has become a film that, you know, fathers show to their children, and then the children show to their children, kind of thing. It's become this wonderful, wonderful film. Yeah, there's another great story from Mel Stewart said he was in his production office, and there was a knock on the door, and this group of black guys came in who were from the Afro-American acting union or committee or something. And they said, we understand you're making a film with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And he said, yes, I am. He said, well, what are you going to do about the Oompa Loompas? Because it's in recent years, isn't it? There's all this stuff about the books being censored, isn't it? They've been republished. The publishers have taken out certain things from Roald Dahl books, haven't they? Because they're quite contentious. And if you read the original book, the Oompa Loompas are sort of pygmies, aren't they? They've been captured by Wonka from the West Indies or wherever, and brought to his chocolate factory and sort of made to work as slaves in the chocolate factory. So these the African American guys were saying, "What are you going to do? How are you going to represent these people on film? How are you going to have?" And it hadn't occurred to Mel Stewart at all what he was. It hadn't occurred to him how he's going to do this, because obviously it's going to be very controversial if he represents it as it is in the book. So he said, well, give me 5 minutes, guys, and I'll have a think. And literally someone put on the spot, and he said, well, okay, I'll give him green hair and orange faces. How about that? So, and we all know now that the Oompa Loompas, that's what they look like. It's only because he was confronted by these guys saying, these guys are racist as hell, and you can't put them on the screen as they are in the book. And he was sort of forced into a corner and said, well, how am I going to get them? Yeah,
and they were responsible for changing the title
as well.
But
they left. And the one guy, before he closed the door, almost as an afterthought, I think, he said, you know, by the way, you do know what Charlie means, don't you? And he said, no, but I'm sure you're going to tell me. Mm. He said, well, in the days of slavery, Charlie was sort of the guy who ran the plantations. He sort of ruled the roost over the slaves. So obviously the connotation and in the black community of the word Charlie is quite tender and raw. And Mel said, oh, look, I've given you the Oompa Loompas. what the hell do you... He said, look, give me a couple of days. I'll sleep on it. And he went back home, and I think he must have been, it was in his head while he was driving home, and he was thinking what to do about it. And I think he must have thought, well, the main character is Willy Wonka, which sounds, I think he visualised what it would look like on a marquee, and if Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, actually looking on a marquee looks better, and people will probably remember it. Charlie, you get lost. It's a woman's perfume as well, Charlie. And it might, but Willy Wonka is something you remember. So yeah, he changed the title because of that. And Roald Dahl objected strongly, but he sold the rights so they could do anything they want, basically. So they changed it. So he became Willy Wonka. And I think people today think the book is called Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, don't they? They're surprised when it isn't.
And of course, you mentioned earlier that you're a big Bond fan and you've got a Bond film in here.
Yes, not the best one. Not the best one, it has to be said. But historically, again, this is the thing about 71 is it's a lot of history going on. There is lots of significant things are happening. So you've got Sean Connery's last official Bond, and you've got the start of the blaxploitation movement with Shaft, Sweet Back's Badass Song.
You got Billy Jack.
Absolutely. And you've got sort of the start, really, of the martial art fad with Bruce Lee's first movie, The Big Boss. You've got Spielberg's first movie. You've got George Lucas's first film as a director. It's quite remarkable, really, what's going on. Sergio Leone, you mentioned earlier, Fistful of Dynamite, which was his last Western. And his last film for about 10, 12 years, wasn't it? Once Upon a Time in the West was his next film.
Once Upon a Time in America, yes.
In America, yes. But it was his last Western.
Yeah.
Significant stuff happening.
What do you make of Diamonds? Diamonds Are Forever.
I like it. Yeah. I mean, it's cheesy as hell. It used to be my favourite Bond film when I was young. Don't know why. I think it's had moon buggies in it and stuff. And it was silly. And it was quite adult, wasn't it, in a way? Because it was quite dark. It was quite bloody, wasn't it? It was quite violent. I still think it's probably one of the funniest scripts. It's a very funny script.
It's the first one where the writer comes in who's very young as well. It's like Mankiewicz, an American writer, Mankiewicz.
Who I interviewed. One of the best interviews I've ever had. I interviewed him for my Broccoli Saltzman Bond producer's book. And I interviewed him for the Hollywood Hellraiser as well, because he was a good friend of Dennis Hopper, going on a tangent, but it's still 1971, the last movie, the Dennis Hopper film, which was chaos. Why do a film about that? I think there is a documentary. But Mankiewicz was very good friends with Hopper. And he went to Taos in New Mexico, where Hopper had a house. He had a compound. And not where they filmed last movie, but where they were in post-production and where he was editing, and where he took about 8 months to edit it, because all sorts of stuff was happening. They were on drugs and God knows what was going on. And he went and stayed 2 days there. And he said he left thinking everybody in that compound is going to die. No one will be left because they're taking so much, you know, industrial amounts of cocaine and God knows what, that, you know, I'll come back 6 months later and there'll be nobody left. But so great story. And some funny stories from Diamonds Are Forever as well, that when Harry Saltzman, because Connery said, I'll do it, but I don't want to see Saltzman. I think it wasn't in the contract, but I think Connery wanted it put in the contract that Saltzman mustn't step a foot on the stage. And if he sees him, he's not going to be happy. I don't think it was in the contract. But
why did he hate him so much?
Well, he didn't like either of them, did he? But I think he took particular umbrage with Saltzman. I think he had a slightly better relationship with Broccoli, but still bad at the end. But I just their personalities, I think, just clashed.
I never quite understood where the animus came from. I mean, I knew that
money, because they were taking shitloads of money. Connery assigned a pretty poor. Well, I mean, he was an unknown actor, wasn't he, when he came in to do Bond? So he's not going to get $1 million, is he, for Dr. No? Got 6,000. It got better by Goldfinger, but it still was. I mean, by then, literally, Broccoli and Saltzman were literally carrying suitcases of money to Switzerland, you know, and putting into bank accounts and things. I mean, the money that was coming in from marketing and was ridiculous. And of course, all those stuff in the 60s, all those toys and games that came out, lunch boxes, you name it, they all had Connery's mug on them. He didn't get a penny for this. And so I think he resented the fact that the producers were making so much money and he was just getting a decent wage, but not nowhere near what they were getting. So I think he thought it was unfair, unbalanced, that the producer were making so much money out of him. By then he was the face of Bond. And there's a story that somebody told me on the set of Journey Live Twice. He was performing a scene, Connery and Saltzman walked on, and Connery stopped mid-sentence and didn't carry on until Saltzman walked off, and then he carried on. By then it was bad, yeah. But no, I'm a fan of Diamonds. Yeah, I am a fan of Diamonds. But I like all Bond films. I think someone said, what's the worst Bond film? And I couldn't think of one. Even the worst Bond film is, you stick it on and you enjoy it.
Oh, there's always fun to be had. Definitely, there's always fun to be had. I'm a big fan of the recent Craig ones.
I think they're terrific. I mean, even stuff like Die Another Day and The View to a Kill, which are people say Quantum of Solace thing, the ones that they, if you haven't seen them for a while, you stick them on, because they're still Bond films.
Quantum of Solace is a hill that I will die on. I think that's a really...
You're one of them, are you?
It's an underrated film. I think it's a really spanking 90-minute, doesn't hang around. Does it make sense? No. Do you go to Bond movies for them to make sense? No.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it again recently, and yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I thought it was good.
It has some real standout moments in it.
And he's very good. Craig's terrific in it, isn't he? Mm.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Of the 1971 films, was there a film that you sort of previously hadn't had much knowledge of, or that you kind of reconsidered, or you had a you changed opinion when you sort of rewatched it?
Not a lot. I was familiar with a lot of them because I'm sort of a film nerd, and so since I was young, watching movies. We were very lucky in the 1980s because suddenly turning up on TV were all these films from the 70s.
Mm.
So you'll appreciate. So Clute was on at 9 o'clock on a Monday night, or The Last Picture Show or something. So I sort of, you know, grew up watching 70s films because they were being shown on the TV for the first time. But obviously doing this book, you know, I did a real, you know, deep dive into it and came up with films I'd frankly never heard of. Or films that I knew of, but they got the significance that I didn't know, like Two-Lane Blacktop and things like that, that had, you know, have huge significance, or are highly thought of, you know. And even films that I guess were sort of thrown out there and are now so revered. Like a film like 10 Wellington Place, which probably came out in 1971 and was just shown for a couple of weeks at your local ABC and then you know, vanished, but is now seen as a masterful film and one of the great performances by Dickie Attenborough as Crippen. It's an astonishing film. And I interviewed Richard's son, Michael, told me some wonderful stories about his dad working on that film. He went to the studio once to have lunch, because usually Attenborough let his family come and see him when he was working, but when he was doing Crippen, when he was doing Willington Place, he forbade them to come. I think because he wasn't a method actor, but he did get into the character, and he stayed in the character all day pretty much.
Mm.
So he wouldn't have been a bag of laughs. he was Crippen, you know. And he noticed when he went home that it still, the shadow was still, this dark cloud was still over him even when he came home. You know, this because he had been, you know, inhabiting this horrendous person, and it stayed on him for months afterwards. But Michael went to see him one lunchtime, and Attenborough was speaking with the voice of Crippen, and he was in full makeup, and he was like having lunch with Crippen. No, it's not Crippen, isn't it? What am I talking about? It's Christie. Sorry, it's Christie. It's not Crippen.
Crippen is he the Victorian?
Yes, right. Yes. No, it's Christie. It's because they begin with C. I'm easily.
Yes.
It's Christie. It's Christie, of course. Yeah. Yeah. John Christie. So it's like having lunch with John Christie, yeah. Or Crippen. But they were both bored as well. Their surnames begin with C, and they were both bored. So you can't, and they wore bald glasses, so you can't blame me for getting
them wrong. And murdered people.
And they murdered people as well. So yeah. Come on, you know, give me a break.
exactly. So I mean, it's perhaps too hard a question to ask what would be your favorite film from this collection, but
favorite films, you'd have to put an S on the end of that, I'm afraid. You've got The Devils, you've got Connection, you've got Dirty Harry, Death in Venice, Get Carter. Get Carter's brilliant, isn't it? Every time I see it, it gets better. There's a good story actually from that. There's the scene at the beginning when they're watching the Mucky Movies. The son of Michael Klinger, the producer who I interviewed for the book, was going out with a girl at the time, and she took him back to her uncle's pad in Lancaster Gate, and it was so swanky. And he thought, this'll do for the opening scene with the gangsters in this sort of London apartment. And he asked her, you know, who lives here? And she's, because we'd love to use it in the movie. And she said, okay, well, what's the film? He said, it's a gangster film. And she laughed because her uncle was a gangster, was a London gangster. And that's the apartment that they used. So it's actually used, it belonged to a London gangster. And his only caveat for them using the apartment was that Michael Caine had to come round one evening for dinner, and then he'd let them use the flat. So I think Caine had to go and have dinner with his, with this gangster. But I think Caine knew quite a few London gangsters, I think.
I imagine it would be unavoidable to be such a London figure.
Indeed. But there's so many great stories like that. I mean, there's another wonderful story from, again, one of these films that I sort of discovered, which was 200 Motels, which is the Frank Zappa Mother of Inventions film, which was directed by Tony Palmer, who I spoke to. And it's this incredibly surreal movie. And the surrealness was, I mean, what the bass player, I mean, it's like the Mother's Invention are Frank Zappa's backing band, right, basically. And they play themselves in the movie. But the bass player sort of had an argument and refused to be in the film. So they had to cast someone to be the bass player. And for some reason, don't ask me why, but Tony Palmer, who directed it, told me that they chose Wilfred Bramble of Steptoe and Son. You would have thought would be the last person you would cast as a bass player. But the joke was he was the oldest bass player in the world, kind of thing. But if you've seen the film, it fits in with the movie because the movie doesn't make sense. Anyway, and poor old Wilfred did all these rehearsals and read the script. And finally, before they started shooting, he walked out. Mm. He thought, this doesn't make sense. I don't understand it. I've never understood what it means. And he walked out. So they had about 4 days to recast. And they were all sitting around in the studio, in this room in the studio, and they couldn't think of who to cast. And either Frank Zappa or somebody said, look, the next person to walk in through that door gets the part. They're all looking at the door waiting for someone to come in. And the person who came in was Ringo Starr's chauffeur, who'd gone out to get some cigarette. Ringo Starr was in the film. He'd asked his guy to go out and get some fags. And he came back with the cigarettes and thought, right, you're the bass player in the film. Yeah. He had 4 days to learn the part and he's in the film. So these are stories you'd only get from the people who were actually there, you know.
Yeah.
Once they're gone, those stories are gone, aren't they?
You're kind of curating a legacy, and
I think so. Yeah, particularly because I mean, I'm looking back and I'm rewriting my ITC book because that's published next year. Republished, it came out about 10 years ago, and I'm rewriting bits of it, and it's coming out again next year. And half the people are bloody dead. I interviewed Roger's gone, Tony Curtis, Peter Wingard, Gerry Anderson. Alexander Bastido, who was in The Champions. So many people I interviewed have passed on, so it's very sad.
It's
a legacy thing of getting them down, getting their memories down of what were very important, now seen as historical, aren't they, almost, because these things are shown at the BFI and stuff like that, aren't they? They are now part of our culture, our cultural history, legacy. They were throwaway back in the 60s, weren't they? They were on at 8 o'clock. People watched them after they had their dinner and then forgot about them. But now they're sort of revered works of art, these things. Yeah. There's another good story. I've got lots of stories. There's another good story from Walkabout. Again, what an amazing film, Walkabout.
That's 1971 as well.
71, yeah. Had an amazing effect on me as a child, that film. Again, you know, probably I saw it the first time it was on. Because it was a great thing in the Radio Times. They put the film and then in brackets, first time on British television. You thought, oh, that's exciting. Gave added impetus to watch it. So I must have been the first showing. And I must have been about five or six. And it's a remarkable film. And people know it's about Jenny Agutter plays a young girl and her son, which is played by the son of the...
Her brother. Right. Her brother, yeah.
That's right. And they get lost in the outback. And they come across an Aborigine who's on walkabout. And he shows them back to civilization, but while they're there, you know, they're sort of living this outback life, and there's some very uncomfortable footage of animals being killed, unfortunately, but it's such a visual film, and Nicholas Rogue, so it's very visual. That amazing, he's one of the most visual directors, isn't he? It's almost century, you know, it's overpowering in its imagery. And I interviewed somebody who was on the camera crew, and they were filming somewhere in the outback, and they found this cave. So they asked the art director to go into this cave and just draw some aboriginal art, you know, like, you know, animal, like you see K drawings in France, and, you know, animals and, you know, spear, people throwing spears and stuff. And then they shot there. And then about 2 months later, they had to go back to the same region to do something else. And in that time, a local businessman had opened the cave up to tourists to look at these amazing Aboriginal cave drawings. And he was charging people to go in. And they just thought that was very amusing. Whether it's still, I mean, I wonder if he told them, excuse me, we did that. Or maybe now, if you go there now and if you go to see these amazing, they might not be the real ones. They might have been done because they might still be there and they might still be charging an awful lot of money to see them. I don't know.
Well, listen, Robert, I've got one last question to ask you, which is a question I ask everybody, every guest, which is, would you recommend a film book for us? So a film book that you've enjoyed and that maybe our listeners can enjoy as well.
And it's not mine, not one of mine.
Not one of yours, if possible.
Probably Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon.
Right, right. Well, there's an anecdotal book.
I mean, that's a great. I think that influenced me a lot in the way to write my books. Again, I'm not sure how much of that is strictly true, but there's a sequel as well, isn't there? There's another one, but the first one is fantastic. Mm. Even if half of it's not true, it's a great read. And it really does, if it's not factual, it does paint a picture, and it certainly gives the colour of what it was like in early Hollywood. It's and there's a lot of sort of scandal stuff about Fatty Arbuckle and all that kind of stuff. People who, sort of poor actress who was out of work for years and walked to the top of the Hollywood sign and jumped off it. And it's all those kind of stories, you know, the dark side, the seedy side of Hollywood. Mm. And yeah, it's a great book. Yeah.
Oh, that's the first time that's ever been recommended. That's a great recommendation.
Right. Yeah. I remember. And there's a lot of nice pictures in it as well. There's a picture of an old actress who was found like 2 weeks after she died and after her cats had a go. So there's a lot of pictures in it as well. Disturbing pictures.
He's an interesting character in himself.
He was. Yeah. I mean, I. Did he do a film in 71? I don't think so.
He did a bunch of movies, didn't he? I'm not sure if something.
Yes, I don't think. Because there's a lot Rising. Of sort of counterculture type movies in 71. Mm. There's Andy Warhol movies and things like that. There's a lot of counterculture stuff going on, which is awful now to look at, but I guess is sort of a documentary of the past. You know, it's like you're looking at a time in history, and it's there recorded for you to go back and look at, not necessarily enjoy, but certainly for educational purposes to see what life was like.
Well, listen, Robert, thanks so much for talking to me, and thanks so much for the book. 1971 is you make a very convincing argument, and even if other people might disagree or agree, it doesn't really matter because the stories are so good.
I think that was another reason for writing it, to sort of create this debate. And it was fascinating because about a month ago, I went on to BBC Radio London and they did a call-in, and everybody who phoned in had a different year, which is lovely in a way, because it's like there isn't really a greatest year of cinema. It's like there isn't a greatest album. There isn't a greatest football player. There isn't a greatest song. It's all personal opinion, personal taste and personal choice, isn't it? If you have six people in a room and say, what's the greatest song ever written? You're going to have six different answers, aren't you? And sometimes this is a very personal thing as well, isn't it? I think why, for me, 71, I think because you know, watching all these films growing up as a kid. I remember watching Shaft when it was on for the first time. It was on at 9:30 and I wasn't allowed to watch it. And I was watching a very adult movie, you know, because and The French Connection as well. You know, this was a very adult movie, and it is a great film. You know, I mean, it's a lot of those films you go back to and you think, oh, it was not as good as I thought it was. But most of these films, you go back and watch them and they're just as good as they were, you know, because they're great movies.
Yeah. Totally agree. Thanks so much, Robert. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it.
So that was me and Robert talking about his book, 1971. Let me just get the title of that absolutely correct. Wait a second, I'm going to Google that and give you the title as it should be.
The title is 100 Films from Cinema's Greatest Year. There you go. 1971, 100 Films from Cinema's Greatest Year. His recommended book was Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon, which I think I'm right in saying hasn't been recommended before, but I might be wrong. I'm not entirely sure, but I think it hasn't been recommended before. This week I've had a terrible bout of COVID, so I've been mostly inside, although I had an opportunity to interview Tim Burton, and that interview will be published in coming weeks in the Times, which was a lot of fun to do. What else have I been watching this week? I finally got a chance to watch And Your Mother as Well, the Spanish title of which is Y Tu Mama También. I can't pronounce Spanish, so I apologize immediately for everybody, which is Alfonso Cuarón's kind of an anti-coming of age story where his very young Diego Luna and I think it's Gabriel Garcia Bernal. Let me just check that as well. It's from 2001. Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna, along with Maribel Verdú. It's a brilliant film. It's a real sort of anti-coming-of-age story in the sense that nobody kind of learns anything. It's the two young men starts off almost like if it was in English language, you'd be thinking it was a sort of super bad American Pie, you know, guys getting off with an older woman. Jealousy and friendship and all that sort of stuff, but because it's made by superior hands, I would argue, it goes off into the the homoerotic subtexts where someone like Judd Apatow might not dare to venture, and in the end it also has this kind of laconic nihilistic narration, which is telling you about all the terrible things that are happening in the future as well as in the present, and sort of everything, all the sunshine of Mexico casts these terrible shadows over what's happening, and you keep seeing them past policemen and stuff, so it's who are stopping other people, and you get a real sense that these people are in some ways really privileged, and it's something that I think goes all the way through Cuarón's work. If you watch Roma, I think it's a fantastic film. I think the film is, in some ways, despite all the praise heaped upon it, is a little bit underrated. He's so aware of his own privilege. There's no sense that he's looking at Mexico and thinking he's looking at it through eyes which are anything other than sort of middle class, upper middle class, and he's lived a life of privilege and in some sense has been cushioned from the many woes of his country. But here as well, it's fascinating, really, really fascinating film. I think that was probably one of the best films I watched this week. I did also watch, I'm going through the Nick and Nora films, the Thin Man movies, and so I've watched a couple more of those, Thin Man Again and Thin Man After the Thin Man, and they're just delightful. They're just absolutely, William Powell and Myrna Loy are just, I can just watch them till until the cows come home, or till Asta barks. One of the more annoying dogs in film history, and I know that might be sacrilege to say, but there is a bit of me that sort of thinks, oh my god, this is sort of like, this is the snappy do of the series. I'm trying to think of other films I've seen this week. Wait a second, I'll go and get my letterbox. Oh, I watched French Lieutenant's Woman, which was okay. Devil's Candy. The Addiction was very good. Abel Ferrara film about vampires in the 90s. Ferrara had such a great patch in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, where he was watching a whole bunch of films like Funeral and King of New York, where he was really at the top of his game. And even though his private life was a complete shambles in this time, he was on a lot of drugs, he was making these really interesting and kind of quite disciplined, tight films. Bad Lieutenant is another one that pops to mind. So I kind of got some good. Also, the Wes Anderson Roald Dahl movies. I've watched Poison and Henry Sugar so far. I think he's really that's a seam where he's
perfectly found his measure, and I think the short story is he could be one of cinema's great short storytellers, because I think he's his aesthetic is perfectly that's the portion, you know. It's like I don't know. So it's something like a really nice tiramisu. You just want enough, you know, you don't want too much. And I know lots of people are going to be shrieking, "No, I want gallons of tiramisu," but you don't, you really don't. You want to, you know, if it's really nice, you want exactly the right amount. You don't want any more and you don't want any less, obviously. Anyway, I just thought I'd add that as a sort of little bit of a bonus at the end of the episode. Or you've already stopped listening, which means it's no harm, no foul. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week. Take care.